Hi, everybody. This is Marjorie Wildcraft, and it really is my pleasure. I'm at the home of Carol Deppe, and Carol is the author of several books that I just, like, these are the real deal. This is, I refer to these books all the time, and I'm just really delighted to get to spend time with you.
Good to have you here.
Yeah. Carol, why don't you show them the books you've got?
Okay. The first one was Breed Your Own Vegetable Varieties, The Farmer's and Gardener's Guide to Plant Breeding and Seed Saving. And there's The Resilient Gardener, Food Production and Self-Reliance in Uncertain Times. And the one we're going to focus on today is The Tao of Vegetable Gardening, Cultivating Tomatoes, Greens, Peas, Beans, Squash, Joy, and Serenity.
That's amazing. And Carol is a magnificent, your initial background was in plant breeding and genetics.
Yeah, actually genetics. Right. Yeah, I came up as a geneticist.
And you tell the story, and this is really good for people to hear, that your parents didn't grow food, and your grandparents, no, you didn't have any of that agricultural background. And in fact, in one of your books, you were saying you were in the laboratory with the fluorescent lights, and it dawned on you that you are a plant geneticist. There's no plants.
Well, I was molecular geneticist, actually. I worked on a fungus, and I had spent essentially my whole career as a, you know, before undergraduate school, and graduate school, getting to be a molecular geneticist. This is back in the days before anybody gave women any chance of getting a job at all. So the very fact that here I was, a head of a laboratory, you know, at a major research university, with my own grants and everything, was really astonishing.
Yeah. Quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, and in my era, the first woman scientist I ever heard speak was me. You know, it was that strange. So there I was in the middle of this laboratory, all empty laboratory, in the dead of night, looking around. And in one way, it was so wonderful that I'd managed to get to this point. But in the other way, something was not quite right. Because I had actually gone into biology, as so many biologists do, because I loved wandering around in the woods and looking at things in creeks and basically being outdoors and thinking about and watching nature. And here I'd somehow managed to get myself into a situation where I was spending 16 hours a day in a laboratory. And it was a laboratory that had no windows. And the laboratories were all in the middle of the building. Offices were around the outside room. And it was completely cut off from
nature or
natural world. And I suddenly realized that something was missing. There was something wrong with the situation. So I went out and I bought 3 potted citrus plants. And I put a potted citrus plant at the end of every lab bench. We had fluorescent lights. And so I thought, well, maybe they would turn the photons into more citrus tree. I bought a book on growing citrus trees indoors. It was the first gardening book I'd ever read.
So here you are now, probably one of the world's renowned plant breeders for the home gardener. And you started out not knowing really any. I mean,
yeah, and I got all the way to 26, an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota, before it ever occurred to me to grow a vegetable or a plant of any sort.
And your first gardens that you started out with were just 100 square feet, very small.
Oh, ha! It was 5 by 3.
Oh, 15 square feet.
It was a tiny little. I lived in a sort of ghetto area in St. Paul, Minnesota, and there was this tiny little patch, maybe 3 by 4. And the front yard was all the dirt there was. And so my first garden was, I planted a couple of Jerusalem artichoke tubers there. I'll tell you, that's a good way to get a start because they're so vigorous.
They're so hungry.
There's absolutely nothing that you can do to kill a Jerusalem artichoke plant in Minnesota.
Well, there's our first tip. Start out with Jerusalem artichokes, right?
Well, you know, it was ridiculous. But
and then and another
Oregon, I was spoiled in some ways because, you know, that was basically not far from the Corn Belt area, and water falls from the sky. That's what they call it, rain. Yeah, we have it in wintertime in Oregon, but not in summer when we're growing summer vegetables. So I had a whole lot of new patterns that I had to learn. And also, well, Willamette Valley soils are very good in some ways. They're lacking certain minerals that we actually have to add as amendments to have much of a garden.
But even now, I know a lot of people say, oh, you know, I got to have the farm, I got to have the acreage, or there's this idea that you have to have a lot of land to grow food. And actually, you don't even really own?
At this point, you know, I have this house, but it's solid clay hillside. I mean, this is not agricultural land. So I lease, basically, my home garden is a few miles from here. So I have to drive to get to my home garden. And with respect to my vegetable seed production for my small seed company and to, you know, grow and release the varieties that I've bred myself, I do that in cooperation with farmers who do the weeding and the watering. And I usually go out with a team of volunteers and plant.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's totally possible growing.
I do not own even a square inch of good gardening soil. In fact, you know, one of the big influences on me has been Alan Kapler. Sometimes the most valuable things people say to you are not actually words of encouragement, they're a kick in the butt. At one point, many years ago, I was lamenting the fact that I didn't have land and so forth and so on. And, this was before I wrote Breed Your Own Vegetable Varieties and so forth. I was talking on the phone with Alan Kapler, and there was this pause. And then he said, I grow and sell 800 varieties of food crops, almost all on borrowed or leased land.
Yeah. Most farmers actually don't own their own land. So this is a story, really, to help encourage people and inspire people, and also that you didn't have any background now, but I will testify that Carol's seeds are unbelievably vigorous and hardy. And,
well, I had the basic genetics. So that was a good story.
But I had to apply
it to plant breeding and so on. One thing I would like to encourage people to do, part of the reason that I have volunteers coming out and helping with the seed production is a lot of people want to learn to garden at a small, at a larger scale than they can do practically with the resources they have. It's basically a survival skill.
Mm-hmm.
In times of disaster, they would need to be able to garden an acre, not, you know, 100-foot or a 25-foot garden bed. So by volunteering at an organic farm, for example, or a CSA, or volunteering with me, they can learn to garden at the somewhat larger but still mostly hand scale.
Mm-hmm.
My volunteers, basically they don't have to grow corn, beans, and winter squash because they get a share of the crop and as part of their help for volunteering. So that means that they can have their home garden focused on other things like tomatoes and greens and so on, and still have all the staples and all the information as to how to produce these staples if they need to. But they don't have to do the labor of producing all the staples themselves every year.
Mm-hmm.
But they still have all those things to eat. So.
Well, you've also really innovated a new technique. I wouldn't say new, I don't know if there's any new in agriculture anymore, but you've come up with this innovative way for people with just a small plot to be able to grow all their own greens. And you've got a really neat system there. Could you?
I call it the eat all greens.
The eat all greens.
I got started completely by accident. Because what happened was I was living in the middle of Corvallis, and I had two tiny little beds, not more than a few square feet, and I never had enough greens. And at one point, I had got somebody to deliver 2 cubic yards of compost, since I didn't have a car back then, I just had them dump it on the concrete driveway. And then after they left, I looked at that 2 cubic yards of compost, and I thought to myself, gee, if I just spread this out on the driveway, I'd have 2 or 3 times as much garbage. I was going to need the compost later, but not for a couple of months. So what could I grow in a couple of months?
A few inches of compost on the top.
A 6-inch deep layer of compost on top of concrete. So it was basically a big shallow pot is what it was, with no sides. Well, it was mid-March, and it rains regularly in spring in Maritime Oregon. And so if it was later in the year, it would be problematic. It's such a shallow pot with no sides because it would dry out too readily. But at that time of year, I thought I just might be able to get away with it. So I chose green white mustard because I really love it as a cooking green, and you know, for soups and stews and messes of greens with, you know, slathered with anything from bacon and vinegar.
The other survival food, right?
Yeah. And, you know, or any kind of salad dressing, you know, or tomato sauce or anything. Nice messes of greens. But I never had enough greens, and so I love green white mustard. So I just went out. You know, it took me about, maybe 6 minutes to spread that compost all over the driveway. Took me maybe 2 minutes more to sprinkle the seeds on there. And then I just watered it in to water the seeds in. So I had maybe 8 or 9 minutes invested in it by then. And then I didn't do anything at all. The compost was weed-free. The plants just grew. And I happened to have chosen the perfect mustard variety. And I happened to have accidentally spaced it uniquely in a way that the plants grew differently than what I was used to. Because normally when I grew green made mustard, I grew it in rows or in wider spacing. And I let them grow up to whole big plants, and I picked individual leaves.
And it's the way a lot of us grow kale or spinach or other things, cut and come again type.
Yeah, it's not cut and come again. It's a picking individual leaves. And instead what happened was it grew very fast, and it was at just the right densities with the plants about 3 inches apart in all directions. And the plants grew very upright, and the entire top of the plant from about 3 inches off the ground on up to, you know, the top foot of the plant was completely succulent and edible, with every leaf being prime and the stem soft and succulent. Part of that had to do with my having accidentally chosen the right variety. Part of it had to do with my accidentally having got exactly the right planting density. And part of it had to do with that being the perfect time of year to grow that particular crop. So I ended up with a situation where I could just clear cut about 3 inches off the ground and cut huge swaths of greenery. Keep the stems oriented and take them into the kitchen and just run a knife through at 1-inch intervals. Very fast preparation time. Drop it into boiling water for a couple of minutes. I had a mess of greens. It freezes real well, too.
So the way to store this would be to just unbag it and put it in the freezer, and whenever you want to eat it, pull it out?
Exactly. And I'd pack the... I would drain it, and I would always save the cooking water, which is tasty and delicious, too. And I would spread the excess greens that I wasn't going to need immediately on a baking sheet, because if you make a pile, they continue to cook on the inside and they overcook. So I spread them out on the baking sheet so they cool off fast. And when they're cool, and when the water that I cook them in is cool, I pack them as solidly as possible into plastic freezer containers, cover them with the broth, and freeze them. And so I basically do that with all the eat-all varieties that I've looked out. But at any rate, so that was a big eye-opener for me. It was a tremendous, I had about 20 pounds more greens.
So it was really simple. You happened, and you lucked out on this first one.
I lucked out, and of course there weren't any wheat seeds in the compost, but in subsequent years I figured out that with the right crops, they grew fast enough so they would simply outgrow the weeds.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't need compost was not an essential part of the picture. Just mm-hmm. any good garden soil would work. But the basic, this was a profound experience for me. I remember standing there after I'd clear-cut part of the patch and was looking at the remainder of the patch and just realizing how much fruit I got and how little work it had taken.
I mean,
I had no weeding. And since it was the time of year that rain falls from the sky, I had done no watering either. I'd simply planted the seeds and harvested. That was all. So I was sitting there saying to myself, or standing there and saying, you know, I always thought that to grow vegetables, you actually had to do a certain amount of work. But maybe you don't have to. You know, the idea of vegetables with no work, that became my new goal. It actually became one of my goals as a plant breeder, that I want to incorporate various things into the genetics of the varieties so that you end up having to do as little work as possible.
Yeah.
You know, before we began this, I was talking about the squash that I'm breeding now, which part of the design is to be the fastest germinating, fastest growing squash on the face of the planet that's ever existed, ever. Well, part of the reason why I'm thinking in terms of those kind of things, okay, I want it to be the most delicious squash possible too, but also I want to build no labor into the variety. And when the variety grows that vigorously, you might only have to do one weeding of the whole patch.
Just because it grows so fast.
And then it's just covered everything. And it was squash.
Could we go back to the, so you lucked out with that, and since then you've developed all the greens that are perfect for this.
Yeah.
But that mustard in particular had some deer-proof characteristics that I thought was very interesting.
Yeah.
You're gonna like
and
this.
Stood me in good stead when I moved to this place because I gardened initially on a few small beds inside deer fencing, but there was more land outside of the deer fencing. And the deer around here are desperate enough so they'll eat anything, mm-hmm. just about. And if they don't eat it this year, somebody never gets any further than writing a book as to how the deer don't eat this before they change their minds and they eat that too.
Right.
What it amounts to is it takes them a while to decide something is great to eat. And there's really only two things that I've not had deer eat. And one is very hot mustards, particularly green wave mustard. They don't do green wave mustard. It becomes completely mild. When it's grown in this fast way, after it's been in boiling water for a minute or two, it loses all the heat. So what's left is a delicious, very succulent flavor. One of the more flavorful greens, but it's completely mild when it's grown fast.
So,
like this.
So this green is actually successful because it tastes horrible when it's raw, but because
deer who can cook.
Only deer who can cook. Okay. Well, we should keep that as a possibility. You never know, right? Only deer.
Even my ducks would not eat this. They would eat everything. The only two plants I've ever had deer not eat in the long term is garlic greens and green wave mustard. That's it. And the ducks. They love the garlic greens, too. can't eat green wave mustard.
But to go back to plants that work well in the eat-alls garden, so the green, and what are the characteristics we're looking for?
Okay.
We're looking for something that grows fast.
Yeah, exactly. So after I had this experience with the mustard, I not only needed to repeat it with the mustard, but I wanted other crops. And I wanted crops that would grow at other times of year, too, because
mm-hmm.
The green wave is really optimal for the spring conditions. So I started trying other crops, and I've probably tried at least 150 different varieties of different crops at this point. The basic criteria are it has to grow very fast, it has to germinate very fast for starters, and then it has to grow and establish plants very fast, because it's only going to be in the ground a couple of months. It has to outcompete the weeds so that when it's growing in ordinary garden soil, it grows up above the weeds so that you can clear cut it 3 or 4 inches high and have the top 12 or 14 inches of the plant that's weed free. And whatever weeds that manage to survive at all are all stunted and dinky and down below the clear cut level. Then on top of that, it has to be capable of, when properly spaced, growing in an upright way so that none of the foliage is dirty or muddy. So that anything that's yellowed or muddy is down below that clear-cut level.
Because I don't
wash it.
Right, you're saying you just cut it, you don't even wash it or process it, you just cut it, chop it.
Right, I just chop the plants at 1-inch intervals across the stem with the leaves. When I harvest it, I actually harvest it keeping the stems oriented. So I'll harvest into rectangular flats, for example, so the stems will all be in one direction. So I can just grab big wads of plant material and just run the knife through perpendicular to the stems. Very, very fast processing. So this is absolutely the best. The eat-all crops are absolutely the best things for freezing because they're the least labor required to actually produce the crop, the highest yield for the amount of land, and very minimal prep time. And prep time for me, that's the biggest thing that tends to stand in the way of my putting up fruit, is I'm just not going to stand over
hot canner
stove and do laborious things in August and September. And this makes it really easy. Just as the course of normally harvesting, say I might harvest half of an eat-all patch, chop the whole thing up, I might have 10, 15 pounds of greens. I'll have one meal off of it that evening, put the equivalent of enough for the next couple of meals just as cooled greens in the refrigerator, and I'll simply freeze the whole rest of it. For the next batch of greens, I do the same thing. So by the end of the summer, I've got my freezer has got all the greens I want in it. I've got greens for the whole rest of the year.
But going back to the plants that work best for this.
Well, and to finish the criteria.
Oh, yeah.
When the plants are at appropriate densities, they have to be upright enough so that the leaves don't get muddy.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be a fairly upright growing plant, not something that's trying to sprawl on the ground.
Right.
The stem has to be succulent. Mm-hmm. And most of the biomass needs to not be in stems. It needs to be in leaves. Part of that is just the nutritional aspect, because the stems actually... the stems of things like bok choy and celery and so forth and so on, they're not very nutritious compared to the green leafy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing I'm always after with the eat-all type varieties, is I want the biomass to be mostly in the form of the green leafy stuff and not stems. So those are the basic characteristics that I needed. So it needs to be able to produce a whole crop in 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point, I want to be able to have clear-cut the entire thing and be able to put in a whole other crop so I can get 4 or 5 successions of greens if I want to. In an area like the Maritime Northwest that's got mild summers, we can start in the early spring, from March right on, and grow the spring-adapted stuff. And most of the things that are grown in the spring elsewhere in the country will grow right through the summer here. Somewhere like Texas, you're going to be growing your eat-alls mostly in the spring and the fall.
Mm-hmm.
So when you grow them will vary from area of the country to area of the country. Anyway, so what other crops could I do this way? Well, one of the ones that I like best is leaf radishes. Leaf radishes, in this country, people breed radishes just from the roots. In China, Japan, and Korea, they have a lot of varieties of radishes that are bred primarily for the leaves. And these varieties are bred to grow very fast and to produce leaves that are not so prickly and that are more succulent and just a whole lot more leaf biomass instead of these dicky little, you know, prickly things that produce big roots. There's one I sell in my seed through my seed company called Shunkyo, that's a Japanese heirloom. That's a good dual-purpose variety that produces a nice radish that's about, it's red, it's about 4 inches long, but it produces eat-all type leaves too. But anyway, so these grow very, very fast. They outcompete virtually anything. And incidentally, people frequently ask me about mixing different eat-all types together. I discourage it because usually one outgrows the other so fast that
so pick one variety at a time.
Pick one, yeah. And, you know, I have several different patches of several different varieties that I'm growing at one time, but all in several patches. So the leaf radishes work really, really well.
So this is a pretty amazing system that in just a few square feet, really, right. Anybody could grow these eat-all greens and have an amazing eat-all garden.
There's some real possibilities, too, and with respect to, especially people with small gardens. I think this makes it practical for a family to grow all the greens that they need, including frozen greens for winter, in just a tiny, tiny amount of space. With respect to urban food desert areas, just tiny bits of scrap land could grow enough greens for a whole neighborhood.
Containers.
A kiddie pool. Because of the fact that the plants are harvested, they grow so fast and are harvested so fast, they only need a shallow layer of soil. And that's part of why my original green wave mustard crop worked in the first place, was even though it was a shallow layer of soil, they were harvested when they were less than 2 months old. So that means that they should really be ideal to grow in pots, basically a flat where the soil doesn't have to be very deep. But instead of growing what amounts to your condiments and your just, you know, a few items to add to a salad, you could actually grow really serious amounts of greens. And the greens, I think greens are probably the limiting nutritional factor in most people's diets. So in urban areas and people with tiny gardens, if you can grow all your greens instead of just a few of your greens, that's a big deal.
That's a huge deal. Yeah.
And increasingly people are interested in gardening on rooftops, and they're mostly thinking in terms of sod or ornamentals or things you can't eat. Well, in order to actually be able to get up there and water and harvest things, you're going to need good access. But once you've got good access to your roof, it should be ideal because you're not talking about a huge weight of soil up there. Real food production is on rooftop gardens instead of, you know, just some greenery in order to look green.
Especially that nutrition. In the United States, it's the elephant in the room we're not talking
exactly
about, but we're really malnourished.
The leafy greens are the big problem.
Well, Carol, you want to whip that book up again, and then everybody's going to want to know where to buy the seeds at. So,
well, just send people to my website, which is www.caroldepi.com, and that's got both my seed company and my new books there.
Okay. So it's www.caroldepi.com,
right.
And you'll be able to pick up
I've got a collection of all of the eat-all varieties, all the ones that I mentioned, plus a lot more.
Okay.
Because I'm discovering new ones every gardening season. I keep adding them. I have a whole section in my seed catalog that's on the website, that is the E. All Greens Garden Collection.
Nice. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for the interview and inspiring so much of us, so many of us. I'm sure I'm gonna grow one this fall.
Good.
Try that out, and I'm also gonna try it with some different containers to see different ways it might work on a patio. So.
Yeah.
But thank you so much.
You're welcome.